the full resources of the Department of Justice, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the U.S. Attorney's Offices, the U.S. Marshals Service, the Bureau of Prisons, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the Office of Justice Programs are being deployed to investigate these crimes and to assist survivors and victim families.
We'll intervene whenever we decide it's in our national security interest to intervene. And if you don't like it, lump it.
The problem with America is not that we go around marauding around the world imposing ourselves. The problem with America in the last 10, 15 years since the end of the Cold War, really in the last 60 years, is that we've been too slow to get involved.
I don't know how many Iraqi civilians were killed, but I can assure you that the number is the absolute minimal that it's possible in modern warfare.
Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
Now, that land over there is yours. You'll go back to it one day because your fight will prevail and you'll have your homes and your mosques back again because your cause is right and God is on your side.
Welcome to the darkened hour.
One day after 9/11, the New York Times will report the FBI agents in Florida investigating the hijackers quickly descended on flight schools, neighborhoods, and restaurants in pursuit of leads. At one flight school, students said investigators were there within hours of the attacks on Tuesday. Also on September 12th, the New York Times would report, quote, authorities said they had also identified accomplices in several cities who had helped plan and execute Tuesday's attacks. Officials said they knew who these people were. Important biographical details about many of them. They prepared biographies of each identified member of the hijacked teams and began tracing the recent movements of the men. In December of 2002, 9/11 victim's relative Christian Breitwiser, testifying before the 9/11 congressional inquiry, will cite these news reports and will ask, quote, how did the FBI know exactly where to go only a few hours after the attacks? How did they know which neighborhoods, which flight schools, and which restaurants to investigate so soon in the case? How are complete biographies of the terrorists and their accomplices were created in such a short time? Did our intelligence agencies already have open files on these men? Were they already investigating them? Could the attacks of September 11th have been prevented? End quote.
Long before September 11th, the American intelligence community had a significant amount of information about specific terrorist threats to commercial airline travel in America, including the possibility that a plane would be used as a weapon. On March 11th, 2002, Director of the CIA, George Tenet, stated, quote, in broad terms last summer, that terrorists might be planning major operations in the United States, but we never had the texture, meaning enough information to stop what happened, unquote. On May 8th, 2002, Director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, stated, quote, there was nothing the agency could have done to anticipate or prevent the attacks, unquote. Once again, the historical facts indicate differently. Throughout the spring and early summer of 2001, intelligence agencies flooded the government with warnings of possible terrorist attacks against American targets, including commercial aircraft by Al-Qaeda and other groups. The warnings were vague, but sufficiently alarming to prompt the FAA to issue four information circulars to the commercial airline industry between June 22nd and July 31st, warning of possible terrorism. On June 22nd, the military's Central and European commands imposed Force Protection Condition Delta, the highest anti-terrorist alert. On June 28, 2001, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice said, quote, "It is highly likely that a significant al-Qaeda attack is in the near future, within several weeks," unquote. As of July 31st, the FAA urged U.S. airlines to maintain a, quote, "high degree of alertness." One FAA circular from late July 2001 noted, according to Condoleezza Rice, that there was, quote, "no specific target, no credible info of attack to U.S. civil aviation interests, but that terror groups are known to be planning and training for hijackings, and we ask you, therefore, to use caution."
In at least some cases, it appears that U.S. intelligence did quickly access existing files on the hijackers. The Washington Post reports, quote, "In the hours after Tuesday's bombings, investigators searched their files on Saddam al-Sisqami and Ahmed al-Ghamdi and noted the pair's ties to a Boston al-Qaeda associate named Nabil al-Maram and launched a hunt for him," end quote. A top customs official would later claim that by checking flight manifests, comparing them with other information such as watch lists, he is able to determine the names of all 19 hijackers by at least 11 a.m. By at least 11 a.m. Later in the day, weapons were found planted on board three other U.S. airplanes. A U.S. official says of the hijackings, quote, "They look like inside jobs," end quote. The New York Times would report, quote, "Sources tell us that U.S. officials are investigating whether the hijackers had accomplices deep inside the airport's secure areas," end quote. Wait a minute. Additional weapons and additional planes? And this shit wasn't in the damn congressional inquiry? Who the hell was running this stuff? Why wasn't this reported? What the fuck is going on?
In the meantime, at the heart of all this lie questions about security. How did these hijackers slip through? We want to spend some time now trying to answer that, beginning at Boston's Logan Airport, where two of the hijacked planes originated, and where our Wyatt Andrews is standing by. Wyatt?
Dan, every airport in America remains closed tonight, but Boston Logan is under a police lockdown. Officials today said that even when this airport reopens, it will reopen under conditions, security conditions, tighter even from what the FAA mandated today. If you look around the airport tonight, you will still see Massachusetts State Police troopers manning checkpoints. No one is getting through those checkpoints except for the law enforcement officials who are conducting the investigation and the bomb sweeps going on inside the airport. Employees, necessary airline employees, are being bussed in from off-site. Police also made the extraordinary decision today to tow some 2,000 vehicles, 2,000 to 2,500 vehicles that passengers had stranded at the American Airlines close-in parking garage. They made that decision rather than allow the owners of those automobiles onto the grounds to retrieve those cars themselves. The intensity of this lockdown, as you mentioned, owes to the fact that two of the four hijacked airliners originated their deadly flights at this airport. The FBI has called it a high priority to find out how that security was breached. For example, they want to know how those knives or box cutters, they've been called, that the hijackers are said to have used, did they come in and simply slip through the common security checkpoints undetected, or were they planted on the aircraft by employees of the airline or the airport who had security badges and thus access to the aircraft? That's one of the aspects of the investigation that investigators are working hard to find out. Significantly, Massport officials today acknowledged that this entire incident caught them at a time where they were upgrading the security badges of all 12,000 Logan Airport employees who have those badges. It's important because as part of that acknowledgement, they admitted that there might be hundreds of these badges belonging to these airport employees that have been discarded, misplaced, simply are not accounted for, but at the same time are still valid. Dan?
Wyatt Andrews.
For penetrating airport security indeed proved to be fruitful for those who wanted to plant weapons. And it didn't appear to have been that difficult. Augenbright, the company in charge of security at all the airports used by the 9/11 hijackers, had virtually no security check on any of their employees, and even hired criminals and even illegal immigrants. I mean, who the hell was in charge of running this operation? Well, anyway, security appeared to have been particularly abysmal at Boston's Logan Airport even after the attacks of September 11, 2001, as was reported by ABC News.
Scrutiny of airline security has intensified, as we have shown you. ABC 7 News has learned the company whose security workers screened passengers on one of the planes hijacked last week has a history of lax operations. ABC 7 News reporter John Harder has that story from Dulles Airport.
Security has been stepped up here at Dulles Airport, but questions have been raised about the company that runs the security here and at a number of airports. Last year, Argenbright Security was fined $1.2 million for failing to provide proper security for 4 years at Philadelphia's airport. Argenbright supervisors were charged with putting employees to work without enough training, falsifying prospective employees' security tests, and conducting no criminal background checks. The president of the Professional Security Association says many airport security workers are inadequate.
A large percentage of them cannot speak English. They cannot read or write English. They are not citizens. They're poorly trained, and they're lowly paid.
Security personnel are supposed to have a good command of English. How do airline passengers view them?
They hire people and they pay them cheap. So if you pay somebody $6 an hour, I don't think you're expecting that person to provide a better service.
It would have been nice to see them doing a better job, more thorough job. Just hopefully now that's what they're doing.
Argenbright President Bill Barber says since then his company has developed a security compliance program, and that when his workers screened passengers who got on the hijacked plane that crashed in Pennsylvania, they did it properly. While there's criticism, check-in security has been intensified. Also, tow trucks in front of Dulles are ready to tow suspicious vehicles, and today workers are installing new security cameras. From Dulles Airport, John Harder, ABC 7 News.
Back up a minute here. How long had these fuck-ups been going on? Well, let's start back in 2000, shall we? January 5th, 2000. The NSACI had long established an Al-Qaeda connection to a very high-level meeting of international terrorists. People like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ridwan Isamuddin, Fahad al-Qusso, and others, like Khalid al-Madar and Waqal Hazmi, of course, along with Khalid Taufiq bin Attash. According to Amy Zegart's book, Spying Blind, the CIA, the FBI, and the origins of 9/11, where she mentions what led to the failures of sharing this intelligence to the National Intelligence Services or even the Bush White House. Quote, viewing the Malaysia tracking failure through an organizational lens reveals a very different picture. This missed opportunity was not the result of individual error or isolated mistakes, but pervasive and longstanding weakness in the CIA structure, the culture, and their incentives. Above all, surveillance of these three terrorists, Khalid al-Madar, Waqal Hazmi, and Salim al-Hazmi, faltered because the CIA's internal structure left no single person or office in charge of the case. As the 9/11 Commission concluded, the CIA's field office structure focused on where, not who. It was designed to cover broad territory rather than track specific terrorists. The Kuala Lumpur field office ran surveillance while the terrorists stayed in Malaysia. Bangkok ran the operation once it realized the terrorists had arrived in Thailand. Nobody, however, was responsible for managing the transition between these two offices or picking up the trail once it had been lost. Back in Washington, the Directorate of Operations, James Pavitt, which oversaw all clandestine activities, the Counterterrorist Center, which was supposed to integrate counterterrorism intelligence collection, analysis, and operations under Kofor Black, and the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit under Richard Blee, which were all watching the operation closely. But they were not overseeing it. This was not a mistake. It was standard practice. As one career clandestine officer put it, the structure was as close to medieval architecture and management as you can find, with personal resources and power controlled by geographic barons managing the field divisions. Structural and cultural pathologies also explain why the CIA failed to get vital information about the terrorists from the National Security Agency and State Department, even though it was designated the lead agency. Instead, CIA officers approached this case like they had approached every case for decades, with a deeply ingrained patriarchal perspective, described by one government official as me, my, mine view of the world, that naturally focused on the agency's own actions and information rather than integrating efforts across the entire intelligence community, end quote. That didn't stop these motherfuckers from lying about what they knew and did know during the congressional inquiries, did it?
Then we come to March 5th, same year, 2000. And the CIA learns some additional information, very critical information. On March 5th, the CIA learns that Hazmi had actually entered the United States on January 15th, 7 days after leaving the Al-Qaeda meeting in Malaysia. So now the CIA knows Hazmi is in the United States, but the CIA still doesn't put Hazmi or Mihdhar on the watch list and still does not notify the FBI about a very critical fact. A known Al-Qaeda operative, we're at war with Al-Qaeda, a known Al-Qaeda operative got into the United States. My question is, do you know specifically why the FBI was not notified of that critical fact at that time?
The cable that came in from the field at the time, sir, was labeled information only, and I know that nobody read that cable.
But my question is, do you know why the FBI was not notified of the fact that an Al-Qaeda operative now was known in March of the year 2000 to have entered the United States? Why did the CIA not specifically notify the CIA? That's my question. The FBI.
Sir, if we weren't aware of it, when it came in the headquarters, we couldn't have notified them. Nobody read that cable in the March time frame.
So that the cable that said that Hazmi had entered the United States came to your headquarters, nobody read it.
Yes, sir. It was an information-only cable from the field, and nobody read that information-only cable.
Should it have been read?
Yes, of course, in hindsight.
And should it have been read at the time?
Of course it should have been read.
All right, my question is, do you know who should have read it?
I don't know that, sir.
Let me read you the staff report. The CIA analyst who attended the New York meeting acknowledged to the joint inquiry staff that he had seen the information regarding Al-Mihdhar's U.S. visa and Al-Hazmi's travel to the United States, but he stated that he would not share information outside of the CIA unless he had authority to do so. That's what he told our staff. Do you disagree with that?
Sir, I've talked to him as well.
You disagree that he said that to our staff?
Well, no, I don't disagree. He said it to your staff. I'm telling you what
he
told.
Did he tell you something differently?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
He gave me a different perspective.
So he told you and he told our staff something differently.
Well,
okay.
But I think it's important, sir.
Yeah, but our time is limited, so let me just...
After the nine attacks are over, the New York field office learns that one of the hijackers was Khalid Al-Mihdhar. One of these FBI agents had attempted to get permission to search for Al-Mihdhar in late August 2001, but he was not allowed to do so. His name, Steve Bongard. He wrote an email about why we weren't going after Khalid Al-Mihdhar. He later testified that upon seeing Almidor's name on one of the passengers' flight manifest, he angrily yells, quote, "This is the same Khalid Almidor we've been talking about for 3 months," end quote. In an attempt to console him, his boss replies that we did everything by the book. Now that this agent is upset and is allowed to conduct a basic internet search for Khalid Almidor, he had been denied permission to conduct even before the 9/11 attacks, but he did find the hijacker's address within hours. So why wasn't Steve Bongard allowed to speak about this? Not only that, the CIA had met with Steve Bongard and officials from the Washington field office with CIA liaison officer Clark Shannon and FBI agent on loan to the Bin Laden issue station, Marco Gillespie. CIA had been phishing the FBI for months, testing them whether they knew who Khalid Almidor's or Nawaf al-Hazmi were, even by providing photographs of the men at the meeting. This led to Steve Bongard to speak about this issue at the Joint House Inquiry.
I just want to move to the FBI agent who I believe was there.
Yes, sir.
Before you begin, I just want to say something. You will never receive the public recognition that you deserve for what you try to do, for your emails, for your efforts to break down wall, real and imaginary, for your effort to break through bureaucracy. And if I have time, I want to ask you about what happened on 9/11. But in any event, I just want you to know that you deserve that recognition. And I'm sorry it can't be public recognition. Having said that, and not knowing how you're going to answer the question, you were at this meeting.
Yes, sir. First off, I'd like to accept that, but on behalf of all the agents that I work with.
And I knew you would do that. I expected no less from you. You were at the meeting. Was there a refusal?
Yes, sir.
Was that accurate, the staff report?
As best as I can recall, sir, I wouldn't be able to add anything to your comments. From what I remember, it's exactly how it occurred. And there's still some disagreement. However, my belief of how events happened to this day are that the analyst herself did not know all the information that the CIA had at that time. And that I know there are different versions of that, so I don't want to speculate about that. But my understanding of events today is that the analyst did not have access to that information either, because we had intelligence agents from the Bureau that were in the room at the time, and the rest of us criminal agents, even though we were frustrated, could have walked out of the room and then received that information.
Did someone at the meeting say he could not share information outside of the CIA unless he had authority to do so and unless that was the purpose of the meeting? Do you remember that?
Not those exact words, but I was told that that he could not share that information with me and my agents at the time, and that information would be attempted to be passed in the following days, weeks, or months.
Do you know whether it ever was whether it was passed in the succeeding days?
No. In fact, I had several conversations with the analyst after that, because we would talk on other matters, and almost every time I would ask her, "What's the story with the Midhar information? When's it going to get passed? Do we have anything yet? When's it going to get passed?" And each time I was told that the information had not been passed yet, and the sense I got from her based on our conversations was that she was trying as hard as she could.
Federal Emergency Management Agency, otherwise known as FEMA, and its contractor Greenhorn and O'Mara Incorporated from Greenbelt, Maryland, had put together a building performance assessment team, also known as BPAT, to conduct a formal analysis of the World Trade Center collapses itself, and produced a report, the findings that FEMA routinely deploys such teams following disasters like floods or hurricanes. The 23-member BPAT team set up the World Trade Center collapse site was assembled by the American Society of Civil Engineers and headed by Gene Corley of Construction Technologies Laboratories in Skokie, Illinois. Corley was previously the principal investigator of FEMA, the study of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City in 1995. BPAT team members are based nationwide and have to communicate with each other mostly by phone as they continue with their regular jobs. While some of them are being paid for their efforts, others are working on the investigation voluntarily. However, they are told not to speak with reporters under threat of dismissal from the team, supposedly because of the delicacy of the subject with which they are dealing. The BPAT team received $600,000 of funding from FEMA and another $500,000 in the ASCE in-kind contributions. The team will have great difficulty accessing the collapse site and evidence that they want to see. They will be unable to get FEMA to obtain such basic data, such as detailed blueprints of the World Trade Center buildings. FEMA will also refuse to allow them to make appeals to the public for photos and videos of the tower that might aid their investigation. Bureaucratic restrictions will also prevent them from making forensic inspections at Ground Zero, interviewing witnesses, or getting important evidence like recorded distress calls from the people who were trapped in the tower. The end product of their investigation is that FEMA, World Trade Center Building Performance Study, which was released in May of 2002. But what did the World Trade Center architects actually say about the subject of whether the towers could have been collapsed under fire from impacting airplanes at the time?
We had designed the project for the impact of the largest airplane of its time, the Boeing 707, the 767 that actually hit the World Trade Center.
Oxford,
was quite another matter again. First of all, it was a bit heavier than the 707, not very much heavier, but a bit heavier. But mostly it was flying a lot faster. And the energy that it put into the building is proportional to the square of the velocity. As you double the velocity, four times the energy, triple the velocity, eight times the energy, and so forth. And then, of course, with the 707, to the best of my knowledge, the fuel load was not considered in the design. And indeed, I don't know how it could have been considered. But, and with the 767, the fuel load was enormous compared to that of the 707. It was a fully fueled airplane compared to the 707, which was a landing aircraft. Just absolutely no comparison between the two.
At the time of 9/11, the FBI Saudi Arabia office was comprised of only a legal attaché, William Radigan, and his assistant, Gamal Abdel Hafiz. Abdel Hafiz was an interesting figure. He was the FBI's only Muslim agent at the time, alongside Ali Soufan, who had been appointed to the position in February of 2001, despite a controversy with his FBI work back in the United States. Some FBI agents accused him of refusing to secretly record a conversation with Muslim suspects. Time will report, quote, "The FBI sent reinforcements to the Saudi Arabian office within 2 weeks of 9/11, but it appeared that the Bureau's team never got on top of the thousands of leads flowing in from the United States and Saudi governments." According to several former employees of the U.S. Embassy in Riyadh, the FBI legal attaché office housed with the embassy was often in disarray during the months that followed 9/11. When an FBI supervisor arrived nearly a year after 9/11 to clean up the mess, he found a mountain of paper and, for security reasons, ordered wholesale shredding that resulted in the destruction of unprocessed documents relating to the 9/11 investigations, end quote. June 2005, the Senate Judiciary Committee will begin investigating allegations that the FBI's Saudi office was delinquent in pursuing thousands of leads relating to the 9/11 attacks. Piles of time-sensitive leads still had not been followed up when the supervisor arrives. The FBI would claim that thousands of shredded documents were duplicated elsewhere, but the Judiciary Committee will assert some material is lost. One employee will later claim that some of the lost information was lead suspicious activity material and information on the airline pilots. Radigan, who had converted to Islam, would later sue the FBI for discrimination, would later claim that the FBI refused to provide him with adequate resources to cope with the workload of 9/11. But it's not the first time that the Saudi issue would come up with the FBI and the State Department. over the few years recently, even under the Trump administration currently, they continue to cover up with Saudi Arabia. So why the fuck are we still covering up for this brutal regime under Mohammed bin Salman, who actually killed a U.S. journalist in Jamal Khashoggi, and actually continues the essence of the Wahhabi ideology to permeate within its southern borders? Well, it goes back a very long time, actually.
Knoxville, Tennessee, good morning for Robert Baer.
Yes, good morning, and thanks a lot for C-SPAN. As one who's opposed this war, I felt like the real agenda of our government we haven't been told the truth. And the writings in newamericancentury.org and in Time Magazine on March 31st reveal that, you know, Wolfowitz and Pearl, whose assistant Secretary of Defense, and Cheney and Rumsfeld had written for years before 9/11 about going into Iraq and occupying it and using those bases for U.S. domination of the Mideast. And they talked Bush into doing the war. So I'm asking your guests, and he's a former CIA man, and I'm asking for an honest answer. Is one of the reasons we went into the Iraq war the fear in our Pentagon that we were going to lose these Saudi Arabian bases? The Pentagon announced last week that they're going to have four bases for years in Iraq. So could you comment on that, please?
You know, I think that's an outstanding question. I wondered why, you know, I worked in Iraq, and I was part of a CIA team that was involved in a coup in 95, so I'm not certainly not supportive of Saddam Hussein. But I couldn't figure out the motivations for this war myself. And I was wondering if it had something to do with Saudi Arabia, knowing that we'd be taken out of our bases we've had since the Truman era, fears that we may lose Saudi Arabia and lose its oil, and maybe this war against Iraq really was a war about Saudi Arabia, but we just felt we couldn't attack Iraq. It's a vital question to our economy, Saudi Arabia, what happens to it and what happens in the region, and maybe by putting bases inside Iraq, we're dealing with the Saudi problem.
Bricktown, New Jersey, for Robert Baer. Good morning.
Hi. Is that me?
You're on.
Okay, thank you. Ever since 9/11, I've been kind of paranoid about terrorism now. And with this war in Iraq, I do believe that we did have a right to go in there to protect our interests and our lives and our livelihood. And I'm just concerned, though, over now with the Saudi Arabia business on what is being told to us and what is going on, really. Mr. Baer, I really am concerned. I just don't know what to do. Don't know what to say. Really confused.
I'm concerned. You know, I left the CIA in December 1997, and before I left, I was interested in Saudi Arabia. I've been to Saudi Arabia a couple times, but I've never served there. And I said, well, you know, what's going on in this country? And so I got into the CIA's Director of Intelligence Computers. And it wasn't what I found, it's what I didn't find. We stopped looking into Saudi Arabia, what went on there. There's a lot of academics that know more about Saudi Arabia than the CIA does. This is not the CIA's fault. It was the fault of the White House over the years. And this is a bipartisan issue that they didn't want the CIA to look into Saudi Arabia. Spy.
And you speculate the reason for that is why?
It's a strategic relationship, and it's too important for the CIA to deal with.
But they weren't the only ones covering up. The FBI would also do it as well. In fact, FBI agent Robert Wright would later claim that the FBI takes extraordinary efforts to gag him in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. According to this Chicago FBI agent, Robert Wright, quote, "On September the 11th, as I watched the World Trade Center towers burn, I did not initially share the same feelings of surprise and shock and dismay most Americans felt. I just thought to myself, it has begun," end quote. On the afternoon of 9/11, he claims that he is called by reporters from the New York Times and 60 Minutes, who already are aware of his issues with the FBI management. They asked if he would be willing to go public with his story. He declined. He would go on record saying, quote, "I'm confident if I had gone public at that time, I would have been fired. I realized my termination would only aid the FBI by allowing management to claim I was simply a former employee who was disgruntled over his termination," end quote. He is not allowed to answer any incoming telephone calls from the general public. The FBI prohibits him from publishing his recently completed book on FBI failures. But that didn't stop Robert Wright from coming out a little bit later on and voicing his displeasure with the FBI and the Counterterrorism Center, including criticizing the top-level management regarding his Operation Vogel Betrayal.
First of all, I'd like to say I'm not representing the FBI. Anything I say is not supported by the FBI or the opinions of the FBI. These are my own personal opinions. What I am about to read to you, I had submitted for a pre-publication review, and it was approved, and this was back in February. Since August of 1999, I've been working to legally expose the very real and foreseeable Middle Eastern terrorist threats to American citizens at home and abroad. From 1993 to 1999, I was assigned to the Chicago Division's Counterterrorism Task Force. In this capacity, I became familiar with the techniques used by international terrorist organizations to surreptitiously move money, launder money in and out of the United States, including through the use of domestic financial institutions in support of terrorist and paramilitary activities and operations in the United States and abroad, including the State of Israel and elsewhere. Against the wishes of some at the FBI in 1995, when I uncovered criminal violations of several of my cases, I promptly initiated active terrorism criminal investigations on these subjects. I developed probable cause to believe that some of these transfers or transmissions have been of money intended to be used in the support of domestic and international terrorism activities. The illegal transfers have supported specific terrorist activities involving the extortion, kidnapping, and murder of at least one Israeli citizen. The successful investigation, which was codenamed Vulgar Betrayal, V-U-L-G-A-R, Betrayal, led to the June 1998 seizure of $1.4 million of Middle Eastern terrorist funding. The seizure was the first occasion that the United States government utilized the civil forfeiture laws to seize assets in the United States. These funds were linked directly to Saudi businessman Yassin Qadi. On October 12, 2001, approximately 1 month after the attack, Yassin Qadi was designated by the United States government as a financial supporter of Osama bin Laden. Despite the unqualified success of the investigation of the Middle Eastern terrorists, FBI management failed to take seriously the threat of terrorism in the United States. Specifically, FBI management intentionally and repeatedly thwarted and obstructed my attempts to launch a more comprehensive investigation to identify and to neutralize terrorists. The FBI's lack of support for the Vulgar Betrayal investigation was obvious to my new supervisor in 1998, who, after only 4 months of being on the squad, wrote, quote, "Agent Wright has spearheaded this effort despite an embarrassing lack of investigative resources available to the case, such as computers, financial leak analysis software, and a team of financial analysts. Although far from being concluded, the success of this investigation so far has been entirely due to the foresight and perseverance of Agent Wright." Close quote. Knowing what I know, and again, this was written 91 days before the attack, knowing what I know, I can confidently say that until the investigative responsibilities for terrorism are removed from the FBI, I will not feel safe. The FBI has proven for the past decade it cannot identify and prevent acts of terrorism against the United States and its citizens at home and abroad. Even worse, there is virtually no effort on the part of the FBI's International Terrorism Unit to neutralize known and suspected terrorists residing within the United States. Unfortunately, more terrorist attacks against American interests coupled with the loss of American lives will have to occur before those in power give this matter the urgent attention it deserves. Realizing more American lives are going to be needlessly lost, no one should expect me to consciously sit idly by and pretend to forget the things I know. By sharing what I know, the terrorism problems plaguing America may be corrected. Knowing what I know, I truly believe I would be derelict in my duty as an American if I did not do my best to bring the FBI's dereliction of duty to the attention of others. Therefore, in an effort to prevent more deadly terrorist attacks against American interests at home and abroad, I have made it my mission, with the legal assistance of Attorney David Shippers, to legally expose the problems of the FBI.
September 14th, 2001. The Miami Herald would report, quote, 45 minutes. That's how long American Airlines Flight 77 meandered through the air heading for the White House. Its flight plan abandoned. Its radar beacon silent. Who was watching in those 45 minutes? That's a question that more and more people are going to ask, said one controller in Miami. What the hell went on here? Was anyone doing anything about it? Just as a national defense thing, how are they able to fly around and no one go after them? In the year after the article and a similar one in the Village Voice, there would be only one other article questioning slow fighter response times, and the article noted the strange lack of articles on the topic, end quote. The 9/11 Commission would ask whether Flight 77 could have been intercepted. Major General Larry Arnold was in doubt, or was he?
Those F-16s launched from Langley could possibly have gotten there before they hit the Pentagon?
It is certainly physically possible that they could have gotten into the area, and it's speculation as to whether we could have actually intercepted the aircraft by that time, because everything that we were doing, remember, was being relayed from the FAA.
Yeah.
We have no visibility on those Finally. Aircraft, couldn't see, no radars, couldn't talk to our pilots. FAA did a marvelous job during that period of time in doing radio relays and assisting us in being able to control
it. Now, if 93 had not crashed, would it not have been possible for the F-16s to have intercepted 93, and do you think they would have?
It was in our intent to intercept United Flight 93. And in fact, my own staff, we were orbiting now over Washington, D.C., by this time, and I was personally anxious to see what 93 was going to do, and our intent was to intercept it. But we decided to stay over Washington, D.C., because there was not that urgency, and if there were other aircraft coming from another quadrant, another vector, we would have been pulled off station, and we would not have been able to, there might have been an aircraft that popped up within the system closer that would have posed a larger threat to the Washington, D.C. area. So we elected to remain over D.C. until that aircraft was definitely coming towards us. And as you know, the brave men and women who took over that aircraft prevented us from making the awful decision, which the young men that were flying those aircraft would live with for the rest of their lives if they had hit.
Co-chair of the commission, Lee Hamilton and John Lehman, even asks the follow-up to Major General Larry Arnold whether Flight 77 could have been shot down, at least.
Finally, as I understand your testimony, it was not possible to shoot down any of these aircraft before they struck. Is that basically correct?
That is correct. In fact, the American Airlines 77, if we were to have arrived overhead at that particular point, I don't think that we would have shot that aircraft down.
Because?
Well, we had not been given authority.
You didn't have authority at that point.
And, you know, it is through hindsight that we are certain that this was a coordinated attack upon the United States.
But had you gotten scrambled earlier, notified earlier of 77's deviance about when it turned east, for instance. Certainly, you could have got the F-16s there, and presumably there would have been time to communicate to either get or be denied authority, no, for 77.
I believe that to be true. I believe that to be true. It had to happen very fast, but I believe that to be true.
What efforts were made that day to contact the president to seek that authority?
I do not know.
Shoot-down authority would have been left up to two people regarding the command authority from the White House. The President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, George W. Bush, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. Where was Bush? He was up in Air Force One flying around, not at the PIAC Command Center itself, where these decisions could have been made. Well, could he have used the phone to get to the PIAC? Well, the phone was on and off all day long. He couldn't get a consistent signal with the PIAC system. As for Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, when the Pentagon was hit, he was outside, not at the PIAC station. So that means that at no point from that forward could Flight 93 have been shot down. Or was somebody else making that order? Well, it couldn't have been Vice President Cheney. He's not part of the chain of command. But without Bush present, without Rumsfeld present, who was running the civilian chain of command? It's up to the military. It's to the Joint Chiefs. Failures, conspiracies, and cover-ups cannot be so easily explained away. From the Bush White House to the intelligence services and to the legacy media, they all had a part to play in pre and post 9/11. But one constant remains, even to this day. Had all the intelligence have been reported and acted on, had it been shared adequately, honestly, between the agencies, had the foreign intelligence services such as Saudi Arabia and Israel worked alongside with the CIA, the NSA, and the FBI, terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001 could have been prevented. According to a closed-door session between the 9/11 Commission and Thomas Drake, the former senior executive of the NSA, the Thin Thread program under William Binney was able to identify 19 of the hijackers who purchased airline tickets and all scheduled for the date of September 11, 2001, while also identifying many of them as al-Qaeda operatives. Drake explains that with this information, the NSA could very well have prevented the 9/11 attacks. When the Department of Justice began their own inquiry, Inspector General Glenn Fine and his staffers were made aware from Alfreda M. Bukowski, a high-ranking CIA officer from Alex Station, that the memo sent by Drake to her regarding Khalid al-Midar's U.S. visa was sent to the FBI. However, the FBI had no recollection of her even having any presence there or ever having received such information, much less sharing it with the FBI. Thomas Drake would later come out years later and talk about this issue regarding the NSA, the information that they collected all the way back to the Yemen hub in Sana'a, Yemen, the meeting in Malaysia, Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf Bahazbi's entry into the United States, possessing dual entry U.S. visas. All this information was collected and stored, or was the information collected and read and not shared for whatever reason? We'll never know, really. And that's the problem. And the problem begins with all the intelligence services. And I must say, Thomas Drake's words here ring true and ring loud.
One of the things that that's not well publicly known is that part of my whistleblowing involved being called as a material witness in the short months after 9/11 for two 9/11 congressional investigations, which I gave highly classified information, operational intelligence, information the NSA had never shared, or information it did not know it had that was never shared, that if it had been shared and properly acted upon, probably would have stopped 9/11 alone, separate from any other intelligence agency or department.
This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang.